So, Dave, how did you first come across magic? Or I suppose the better question is, when did you first have an inkling that what you've been told at school probably wasn't all that there was?
One of my earliest childhood memories is my dad telling me that magic wasn't real.
Okay.
I think I was coming up to my fourth birthday and I'd asked for a magic wand, just like Sooty's got.
Right, you know, right.
One that can do magic. And my dad sort of obviously honourably felt he had to disappoint me, that he couldn't provide me with something that would make, you know, my will manifest. So I got interested in science from there, and it was really... I think I really sort of started to emerge from that in my late teens when I took a lot of LSD.
Sure, right.
Yeah. This is late 60s, early 70s. And it was very strong in those days. And it had, you know, very interesting effects on me. I got very into it for a couple of years, basically. And I recognized...
Well, were you seeing it as a party drug, or had you some sort of... like insight, like was it a spiritual kind of thing at that point, or just a bit of fun? Or
it was kind of like I had a sort of confused ragbag of desires for what I wanted out of it. You know, I'd sort of heard the psychedelic rock music and thought, wow, you know, that sounds like an amazing state of consciousness.
Right.
And obviously I wanted to do it just for the fun. But when I actually took some the first time, it turned out to be quite a low dose. And I was aware of myself as a web of energy. I was immediately aware of myself as, like, rather than just being a self in a body, I was instead a sort of kind of, you know, sensitive, leaky energy system.
Oh, right, okay, right.
So, you know, that was kind of the first time I'd ever really thought that. I'd fallen for the, you know, the silly old Cartesian dualism before that.
Right, okay.
But, it's not right, that. It's bollocks. This, you know, it's my, when I close my eyes, it's not like I have a body. It's like I am a set of sensations, or I feel a set of sensations, and none of those directly maps onto the seeing a body from the outside, you know. So it was like a sort of a new dimension to my internal world.
And up to that point, had you had any sort of, like, was your family religious at any way, or were there, like, I know your dad said that magic didn't exist, but... you can have people who don't believe magic exists but still go to church on Sunday, you know, like, what was the family background or the society background at that, you know, before your LSD?
Yeah, no, not really. No, my family were kind of like nominally Church of England, which meant, you know, kind of non-religious, really. So it was that was about it. Although actually, because my mate was going to Sunday school, I asked if I could go to Sunday school when I was about kind of like 10 or something.
Right.
Maybe. And went along and really enjoyed the stories kind of thing, and talking about the stories in the Bible, and quite enjoyed that. And I've always enjoyed singing. So, you know, occasionally enjoyed going to church just to sing the hymns.
Right. But there was no kind of belief, I suppose, at that, but there was no anti-belief. Like, you weren't an atheist, or, you know, you weren't kind of...
No, there was no
care right away.
No kind of pressure from my family. Nothing I had to resist, really, there, right. You know. I don't, it was all a bit loose.
So after your LSD experiences, did that kind of awaken a want in you to, you know, search for some answers, or was it, or what was the kind of effect?
Well, yes. I mean, I had all sorts of interesting experiences. Like I had energy sort of that flowed out of me and affected other beings. I wrote a bit about this in Life Force, and other times I accidentally zapped a cat just by...
Oh, wow.
Throwing some energy across the room. The cat was fine afterwards, but it's just that it really jumped in the air, and it was like, you know, just so, oh wow, this energy stuff is real.
And were you trying to do something, or was it just you happened to move your hand in the correct direction?
And I just sort of went like that, and this bolt of energy shot across the room and hit the cat, which was sleeping, jumped in the air and got out of the room. And I thought, oh god, you know, I went and looked to see what was happening with the cat, and it was fine. It had just like jumped out into the yard and was all right down. That was my friend's place. And so I knew that, you know, energy was real. Then I had what was a very strange kind of moment where it seems as if I was contacting some spirit. That didn't last very long, but I began, you know, my normal sort of reality began to fray at the edges. But those were, in a way, the minor things. There was something much bigger going on that I would now say that I actually was given an opportunity to listen to the deepest part of me, what I've come to know as the silent knowing, a kind of spiritual intuition. And but I had various instances of that and came to know it during those couple of years. But then one day I had an experience which was quite unpleasant. It was sort of a pretty sort of dark set of situations arose in my mind and this trip with a few other people. And I literally walked away from it. I walked for miles until I'd calmed down a bit. And then I sort of looked at what had happened and I realized, looking back on it, some while later, I realized that I'd made a decision to leave aside all that stuff. So I did, you know, I did take acid again a few times after that, but it was on the downslope after that. And it was just...
I assume that wasn't like your first bad trip or like, I'm sure you...
I did have... I actually had a couple of bad trips and it was like I'm glad that I had a sort of naive... intensity about it all at that stage, because I went down to Hyde Park for a free festival where the Pink Floyd were premiering the Atom Heart Mother.
Oh, wow.
In 1970, I think it was, in about August or something like that. And I was down there with a friend of mine who'd been and scored some acid. So we took one and everything got a bit strange at first. And then I thought, oh dear, this is going somewhere different and not very pleasant. So for some reason, I thought the obvious response to that was to take another two.
But of course, logically speaking, it's the perfect thing.
And this is kind of following a bad one I'd had a few weeks before. And I'm glad I did that because it sort of just burned through it, basically. I just got to this state where I felt really helpless. And I just, you know, and then this voice came into my head and it just said, you cannot allow this to continue. All right, then, and stop the bad stuff happening. And I just exploding with golden light, my heart chakra opening, and all of that sort of good stuff. And it was a wonderful day. So I kind of burnt through the worst of my bad trip stuff on that session and never really got afflicted in that way again. But it was still a case, it was the next year that I had this experience which went beyond that and went into a darkness I couldn't handle. Right. So
it is interesting that you physically walked away. Like, I mean, like any amount of symbolism in that. Like,
we were all out in the countryside. There was myself and my girlfriend at the time. But our relationship was a bit dodgy. It was breaking up at the edge, which I think is the emotional tone, the background emotional tone.
Okay,
made things so difficult. And a bunch of people, only one of whom I really knew, some student people from the university. And my girlfriend was at the university, I wasn't. And we're all out there and I just felt completely alienated from everything that was going on. And I realized that I was not going to be, you know, that my thing with my girlfriend was not, you know, not going to continue much longer. Mm. And I just like everything started getting really unpleasant and horrible. And I thought, OK, I just need to move. I just need to keep moving. So I walked back about 5 or 6 miles into Sheffield and I calmed down a lot by the time I found somewhere to go and have a quiet beer and think about it all.
Yeah. And did that then, I know you said you took it a couple of times after, but that was probably, was that the peak kind of moment where you go, right, that whatever I had to learn from this experience is now complete? Or what was your kind of conclusion out of that?
It was more of a realizing that I reached, you know, it was what I remember kind of like getting a bottle of beer and going sitting in a back room in this bar. And I was on my own for a while and I just thinking about what had just happened. And it was all as if this voice was in my head and it was kind of telling me things, but in a really strange way. There was this sort of like globs of meaning that later I sort of translated. And there was three overlapping bits of meaning. And one of them was that I'd made a decision, although at first I thought it was a decision I had to make. Later I realised I'd already made it. And then there was something that was going to happen when I was about 64 or 65. And then this idea of death. And yeah. Even then I recognised that death could, you know, could symbolise extreme change. It didn't necessarily mean to physically die. So I thought, oh, wow. You know, I was 19 at the time. So I thought, oh, this stuff's going to happen like 46 years in the future, so it's no concern of mine at all. When you're that age, you either think you're going to live forever or you're going to die next year and it doesn't matter, you know.
Yeah. All going to die at 27 anyway.
So it was like I just realised that a whole part of my life, eventually looking back on that some while later, I realised that a whole part of my life had kind of come to an end for the time being. It was frozen. And then, you know, as it happened, funnily enough, in, you know, when I was about 64, when I was actually in my 65th year, before my 65th birthday, I did have one of the profoundest spiritual experiences of my last few years. And that's a result of meditating daily.
Were you kind of expecting it, or had you forgot about the kind of the premonition or...
I kind of was. I mean, a few years before that, I'd sort of dug back into my memories and kind of like tried to line the whole thing up and see what was happening. And I thought, well, something of spiritual significance, you know, assuming I'm not actually going to die, I don't think it would have bothered whatever it was that was talking through me, which I suppose now I'd think of as my holy guardian angel. Whatever it was that was talking through me didn't... you know, wouldn't have bothered telling me I was going to die. That's a useless piece of information. It was more to do with I was going to be completely transformed. So I was thinking for years before, I was expecting some sort of profound spiritual experience. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, because I suppose that can, in many ways, you're told that can hinder, you know, the expectation or the longing or whatever can kind of hinder it. So it's interesting that you're still aware of it, but it still happened. I suppose that's the nature of prophecy too, isn't it?
Yes.
So, right, you're early 20s at this point. You've closed the chapter on your life in some ways, whatever. So, what happened next? Where did you go?
Well, next I went back to the my other main thing that all through my childhood had been science. I was a science kid for various reasons. I think science was kind of like a substitute for magic from the age of four onwards. I got interested in science, recognizing at some gut level, I suppose, the Faustian bargain, and this is the modern. Sure. With it. And I found science really, really easy to get top marks in at school. So it was like lazy. That was it. I just was the science kid from then on, and I was no good at anything else. So I just did science. And I went and did a science degree. And I went late. I went to do that late. I didn't go kind of like go into my degree course straight from school. I did do another course, but I didn't find that very interesting. And then I sort of like dropped out. And that was still my acid years. And then at about the age of 21, I actually did go to college and take it seriously and got a degree in molecular biology.
Oh, wow, cool.
I think I got my degree in 1975. And by the end of that, I was already sort of starting to think, well, you know, science has really got its limits, hasn't it? I knew this when I was in my acid years, but I started looking at it philosophically, reading a bit of philosophy and realising that what I'd thought of as science was a sort of secure intellectual place to be. It was okay. It was kind of like, come down from all that stuff and just get sensible. Okay. Also, over that era, I got together with someone and we'd had a child. So at the age of 21, I was a father. So I realised I had to take life a lot more seriously.
Sure. You know? Yeah, yeah. And was that part of the reason why you went to college to get your degree as well?
Yeah. Thought, yeah, come on, I need a career. You know, I need something I can do that will help support my family. So I went along with that. But by the end, like I say, by the end of the course, I'd started to realise that science kind of like was suspended over an abyss of doubt and incoherence. And, you know, it wasn't as secure as I'd thought. And
were you expecting in some ways that, you know, you'd be convinced of materialism or whatever by doing the science?
I think there was that element of it sort of like it would, you know, kind of like save me from this morass of weird spiritual longings, you know,
right.
Which I couldn't make any sense of. But instead, I discovered that, you know, that science didn't provide that kind of coherence at all. But I continued with the science career. In 1996, I went up to Leeds to do some postgrad work at the university there. And during that first year there, I took up meditation. I just did the transcendental meditation thing, you know, where you go along, take a flower and some money, and they...
Yes, and some money.
offering. And And they give you a mantra. And I did that every day and quite enjoyed that. And I thought, oh, I want to go a bit further than this. And one lunchtime in Leeds Student Union, while I was having my, you know, pie and peas lunch or something, I picked up this leaflet about an occult group.
Oh.
And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. So I went along to a meeting, and it was a bunch of people who, it wasn't the Leeds University Union Occult Society, but that evolved out of this because me and this other guy decided to found a proper university society, because then we'd get money and we'd be able to use rooms in the university union and stuff. So we formed the LUUOS, which existed way into the 1980s and possibly beyond, and then mutated into something else and became unrecognizable. But yeah, we were the founder members of that. And the first group, though, the occult group, a couple of people who set that up were fans of somebody who called himself Amado Crowley.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The alleged son of Mr. Crowley.
Yeah, the so-called son.
Yeah.
And he actually kind of visited Leeds a couple of times over the next year or so. And increasingly, I realized that that wasn't my path. But by then, I'd got really interested in magic and had started reading Crowley, started reading a little bit of Golden Dawn, the post-Golden Dawn stuff, and Dion Fortune, all that kind of stuff that was available, mostly kind of westernized esoteric Kabbalah, essentially.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. So, yeah. That
and is that what the kind of trust, or was that the kind of theme of the occult society, was that kind of Kabbalah-led Golden Dawn?
Well, we were,
or was
all...
it more exploring, you know, like, was there elements of Buddhism we used or whatever, like, was it more open, or like, what to talk about, I suppose.
It's a good question. I'm searching my memory now to remember some of the earliest talks, but I mean, I suppose we're talking about, like I was saying, about 1977. And by 1978, I'd actually come across, because The Sorcerer's Apprentice is in Leeds, and that's one of the UK's probably oldest and perhaps best in some ways occult supply service. And at the time it was a shop, I think it's all online now, I'd imagine, I haven't looked at it for years. A strange, dingy, dark little shop that smelled wonderful when you walked in. And Chris Bray, who ran it, was quite into giving people a bit of, you know, pointing people in different directions. So buy books from there, chat with him. And I learned, you know, I first came across Chaos Magic there in 1978, Lieber Knoll, first edition.
Right. That was published out of that shop, wasn't it, originally?
Yeah, it was published in 1978. And I think, yes, Chris Bray certainly had something to do with it, although the first main edition was Ray Sherwin's, what was he called? Morton Press is what he called his imprint. And so we started, you know, that was perfect for me. So we'd been kind of like just having little discussions which didn't really go on. And all of a sudden there was an overall frame to look at magic through. And that really suited me. And I thought, oh, this is magic for people with a science background, you know, recovering scientism. And so that was perfect for me. That early sort of Carolian semi-scientism really matched my mood at the time and helped me step into magic full-time as a belief. So I started experimenting with sigils and so forth, and other people in our little group did, and we started inviting people. We had a few people from different traditions. We had Patricia Crover, the high priestess witch. She came along and did a really good talk. We had, of course, Ray Sherwin, because he was local. The Sorcerer's Apprentice every Saturday used to open its old shop, which was an even dingier little shop next door, which didn't use much, but they used to open it for a coffee morning on Saturday. And you could have this sort of like, you know, pay a few pennies and have some instant coffee. Nice. And there's a kettle in there and there's little sachets of instant coffee. So you could sort of like sit around and it was amazing, because at the time, Ray Sherwin, of course, is living just out in a village just outside Bradford, which is only 9 miles. So they're almost like a conurbation together. And so he and Pete Carroll had just come back from his travels. And so he'd been to the Far East and Australia and stuff. So they used to turn up for these coffee mornings sometimes. So I got to meet them, and I got to meet other people as well, like who's not as famous, like Richard Bartle Batelli, is an artist.
Okay.
Designed the, I think one most thing he was most notorious for was probably the sexual tarot.
Right.
like something out of Illuminatus.
Yeah.
And various other people, and some various people.
And what was your kind of, I don't mean, I suppose, opinion of these people. What was your kind of general feel like? Would you go, oh, these people, you know, they have the secrets, or did they feel more contemporary as seekers? Or what was, like, was there a hierarchy, or what was the...
There was. It was a sort of, it was only a short hierarchy. There wasn't, I didn't imagine great levels behind it, but I did think of Ray Sherwin and Pete Carroll as being people who were more experienced than me and who I could learn from.
Right.
And in 1980, there was enough people who were interested to form a chaos magic group, which was basically the first IOT group in Britain.
Yeah.
And it was in, that was based in Ray Sherwin's village, East Morton. So I was, you know, I jumped at the opportunity to join that. And quite rapidly after that, I realized that there was only a kind of a shallow hierarchy here. It wasn't that these people weren't that much more advanced than me. They might have done a bit more practice in some areas, but, you know, the whole thing of chaos magic at that stage, one of its really good features was this kind of punk DIY attitude where go in and just, you know, slap something together and try it and see what happens. And of course, you get results. Of course you do.
Mm.
So it's like, wow, I can get results with such a simplistic technology. So, yeah, so there wasn't, the hierarchy didn't really last very long.
Right. And what was the kind of the general feel of chaos magic at the time? Because I know it's like, now it's, you know, it's everywhere and everyone's kind of quite accepting of it. But I suspect that when it came out first, it was kind of frowned upon, probably, maybe from the more traditional people, or are still kind of frowned upon, I suppose, by the more traditional people.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, I mean, there was some people who came along to the coffee mornings used to mock it. By the way, just as a quick aside, one thing that those coffee mornings taught me was that never underestimate the power of a soiree.
Right.
Well, right, a couple of two or three of, you know, people who've got something, and then other people just coming along, because that really was the nucleus of chaos magic in this country. I think it was probably the main nucleus of chaos magic in this country at that time.
Right.
And so, but some of the people that came along to those coffee mornings did mock the whole chaos thing. It was just like, you know, just sloppy work. There was some kind of strict Kabbalists from Batley who used to come on, and from up in the hills, and they would mock the whole thing. But I sided with the chaos kids. I think the attitude for me was, it was really exciting. I remember seeing a book by Robert Anton Wilson. I think it was Illuminati Papers Volume 2 or something. It was Cosmic Trigger Volume 2, one of those ones he brought out in about 1980, 81. And it's got this picture of somebody sitting there. I'm not sure whether it's two people or one people. You can find this cartoon. I'm sure it still exists online. It's a cartoon. And the heading is, "Hey, man, are you only using half your brain?"
Right.
Like stone furry hippie in one side, and there's kind of an intellectual in the other. And the point being, you know, that Wilson's multi-model agnosticism would give you a richer experience of life, because otherwise you'd be prejudiced and stuck in one view of reality, which of course is what Illuminatus was all about. It wasn't as explicit.
Sure.
Illuminatus is probably the first book I read that convinced me that I could believe in magic as a real thing. I read it in about 7, at the beginning of that phase. But yeah, there was just, look, that's how it seemed to me. It seemed like I'd, you know, as this science kid had gone into acid, it seemed to me that this was the way forward. It was like, wow, you can take all the sort of critical perspectives of science and the vast molten mystical and magical perspectives of magic and work them together. And that's what it was for me. Of course, after a while, I realized that it wasn't like that for everybody. And in fact, Pete Carroll was quite scientistic. Mm. You know, his approach to magic was quite scientistic. But by then, I wasn't bothered, and I was developing my own take on it anyway. So I mixed in as much mysticism as I wanted. But yeah, it was exciting. It was like a completely new thing.
And what sort of magic, like, what were you doing magic for? Or what was, I suppose, the big question is, what was the moment, or what was the magic, the sigil, the ritual that absolutely convinced you that, all right, I'm onto something? Or was it a more kind of amalgamation of a number of different workings? Or
Oh, it was a bit of both. There were some moments where I just blew my reality apart completely, but there was a drip feed mostly of minor successes, like for instance losing touch with an old friend, and I did a sigil to get her to get back in touch with me, because I thought, well, who knows, maybe she's got information about where I am, and like a few days later, bang, she got back in touch.
Right.
Yeah. And things like that. That was one I happened to remember. There's all sorts of other minor ones, but there was a really weird one, which, I mean, I'm still struggling to interpret and integrate into my worldview. And that's when I saw somebody levitate.
Oh, wow.
Right back in the early days as well. And that was just four of us were doing this, you know, Kabbalistic path working together. We were completely sober. I mean, literally, I got into a phase of not even smoking dope much at that time. And none of us had had anything to drink. I mean, the strongest thing we'd had was a cup of tea, literally.
That's dangerous stuff, cups of tea.
It must have been, yeah. Around at my girlfriend's place, and there's this other couple, and four of us have been doing this meditation together, and we're all sitting around afterwards, and we're all quite tired, and we're just sitting there. And she, my girlfriend, she's laid on the floor in front of the fire, and she raises her hand to her brow, and suddenly she's tilted at about 30, 40 degrees to the horizontal, her feet in the air and the back of her head resting on the ground.
Wow.
And I look at the other two people, I'm going sort of, and they're going, yes. You know, we're all completely blown away, and we just waited a few more seconds, and she's sort of like, all of a sudden she was back down again, but not with a slam, but just as if there was an instantaneous translation.
Oh, right.
So I said to her, did you just
levitate?
Did you just rise into the air? That, you know, what did you experience there, or words to that effect? And she said, yeah, I tried not to be a leading question. That's right. I said, what did you experience just then? And she said, I just rose into the air.
Wow.
You know, so that, like I say, I'm still struggling to interpret that. There isn't any respectable way to interpret an event like that.
No.
Just completely, it's one of those Fortean, world of the damned things. It's just one of the damned bits of evidence that you cannot find a respectable place for.
And I suppose one of those things that, if depending on who you're saying it to, people either believe you or don't believe you, and there's no convincing, you know? Like, there's no, because without an explanation, you can't convince anyone.
Yeah. I mean, I've written about this a bit. I mean, she did have strange things happen around her, although that was the strangest. She was someone who, she was a bit like one of these people that carry poltergeists around with them, you know, weird energy stuff happened.
Yeah.
And I come across one other person many years later, and we actually nicknamed him Pete the Poltergeist, because everywhere he went, this sort of stuff happened, you know.
Yeah. So what sort of authors and what sort of books were you involved with at this time? Like, it was obviously a bit of Robert Anton Wilson. Was there anyone else?
Yeah, I was reading, sort of working my way through Crowley, and finding most of it too sort of overblown for my taste at that stage. I was into the stripped down punky minimalism of chaos discourse, really. So yeah. I liked Crowley. I saw a lot of value in his writings, and I saw him as a direct predecessor of chaos magic, which he was in a way.
Yeah.
Which, of course, Pete Carroll did originally admit that, then later on went off him and started to say that, you know, chaos magic grew out of other things. But there was a bit of that, and I was still recognizing that there was something missing in my own magical world, that the amazing experiences I had on acid were just not entirely being represented. I wasn't entirely working towards that, which is part of the world's been this kind of like, I wonder if I can kind of like, having had a helicopter flight over the sacred mountain, am I going the right way on foot now? You know,
right,
to reach
yes.
That was kind of like part of my inner model. And I wasn't sure I was. And I started reading a bit into the more mystical side of things, like Dion Fortune and so forth, looking back at that stuff. And I ended up, then I actually collided with a bunch of other people, a group from Southampton, actually. I was living in Leeds, but they were working this kind of post Dion Fortune sort of scrying and spiritual kind of aspiration sort of magic. So I joined with them as well. So I was kind of straddling two worlds at that point. I was doing all this, you know, kind of like Baphomet stuff and stuff with sigils on them in Leeds, and then going out to Southampton and doing visionary stuff involving the Tatvas and the I Ching and inner planes adepts and things like that. So it was, I was trying to straddle both worlds.
And had you an overall goal that you were trying to attempt, or was it just kind of, you see what was happening? Like, were you, was there kind of any sort of sense of aiming for, like, say, an awakening or HGA contact, or what was, like, what was the overall drive?
I went in, the overall, it gradually, it took years for me to articulate what I was doing, really, because I kept alternating between belief and disbelief in awakening and in the idea of the Holy Guardian Angel and things like that. Sometimes I had experiences which seemed to indicate that all that stuff was real, and then something in me would just slam shut and say, no, come on, it's just, you know, people sitting around for years and they eventually achieve some exotic state and they just say that it's better than the state everybody else has got, you know. So yeah. I was occasionally cynical about the whole thing. So it took a long time. It's only really much more recently that I've started to understand how it all fits. Well, not all of it, but how my quest fits together.
Right. And at this, when did you start doing your writing, and when did you start emerging as your kind of your own Dave Linus into the world? You know, like, was that around this time or?
A bit, but I never published anything I did there. Well, there were a few things that I wrote in the early 80s, because Chris Bray at the Sorcerer's Apprentice, he started a magazine, well, he'd taken the name of a defunct magazine from Leeds, The Lamp of Thoth, which of course, what the gutter press called it, The Lump of Filth. So it stuck. But I wrote a couple of little meditations for that based on my own pathworking experiences and so forth, like, you know, kind of tarot card type meditations. And then I got a bit more adventurous, and the group in Southampton, we started looking at gematrias that might interpret the Book of the Law and things like that, you know. And so I published a piece on that, which I recently rediscovered in my notes and dug out and reread. The Lamp of Thoth. The Lamp of Filth was good for me in the early days. It was an opportunity for me to be stimulated to write things. But I mean, I didn't really write much until Chaos International came along in the mid to late 80s.
And to give out, you wrote a good bit for that. Was that like an ongoing kind of?
Well, it emerged from the scene I was in, from the magical group I was in with Ray Sherwin and a few other people in the, let me think, when did that group start? That would have started in about 84, I guess. And by about 86, we were, you know, talking about putting a magazine together. I suggested the name Chaos International, actually, as a result of my girlfriend. She occasionally used to read sort of upscale fashion mags just for the hell of it. And she had a copy of Harper's and Queen International lying about. So I just thought, you know, let's go for really sort of snobby classy here as an ironical thing. So I said Chaos International, and it stuck. So that's how it got its name. And the first issue was, you know, nominally anyway, edited by Ray Sherwin. I think the second was as well. And then I took it, the idea was the editorship would rotate, and I took on the third and fourth, and then passed it on to Phil Hine, and then it got passed on to Ian Reid. Nobody else really wanted it after that, so it got, you know, Ian got stuck with it and made a really good job of doing a whole series up to issue 23.
Right. Oh, I didn't notice that quite that many. That's cool.
Yeah, there were 23. And then there was a couple more after
that. Of course
that.
There was 23. Of course there was 23.
But yes, I started doing a lot more. The longest thing I'd ever written was for the first issue of Chaos International, was Magical Ionics. It was just my ramble about how magic fitted into the spirit of the times, as it were.
All right. And what were you doing at this time, I suppose, professionally? And what was your real life? Or what was it? Were you still doing the science thing, or had you dropped that altogether? Or?
Well, yeah, I my post-grad work came to an end without a higher degree. I made various not so good decisions during those years, and ended up on a research project that really went nowhere. So that came to an end in 1980. And I was unemployed for a bit and trying to find my feet, but really kind of full time into magic and not being that bothered about work for a while. And then, yeah, gradually started building up other interests, started making incense, started my own little sort of attempts to sell incense and other magical things that I'd made. And the next time I actually had anything approaching a respectable job. A lot of the 1980s, I was in and out of trying out various jobs and things and not settling into anything. And then in the late 80s, I got an opportunity to, with a couple of friends, to buy out Ray Sherwin's shop, Id Aromatics. Oh, right. And he wanted to move on and do something else. So we bought him out and ran that shop and wholesale and mail order business I was involved in it for 9 years. We turned it into a limited company, and I sold my shares in that in 98 and went off and did other things. But yeah, that was the core of my work, was the world of aromatics, actually, for a few years.
Right, so you were completely at that point embedded in magic as both private and professional. That's pretty cool. Was there a sense at some point that it was more than just a couple of people hanging out on a Saturday morning drinking tea, that it was becoming the chaos magic kind of thing was getting a bit more international, I suppose, to use the thing? Was there a feeling that you were, part of a bigger movement than a local movement?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, the IOT was founded nominally in 1978, and I think it was just really Pete Carroll and Ray Sherwin and a couple of other people. And then there was our group. And then there was, I think there was another group in London quite early on, which would have coalesced around Ian Reid and Ingrid Fisher. And but it was all very, very small until 1986 or 87, when Pete Carroll announced the formation of the Pact of the Illuminates of Thanaterra. So it was a new stage of the IOT. Okay. And it was of it, because he'd got a new working partner who was much better. I mean, I'm no good at self-promotion and all that stuff. Neither was Pete Carroll, but he started working with Ralph Tegmeyer in the German-speaking world, who's someone who's very, very good at publicity and promotion. Right. And so they basically relaunched the IOT, and within a few years it was many, many times the size. It went from being probably a dozen people to being many times that in just a couple of years. And that was really 1987 onwards is when it really blew open. I think we did something in Leeds. We did the Chaos Symposium, name obviously inspired by the Thelemic Symposium that used to happen every year in Oxford. Morgan used to run, let's have a Chaos one in Leeds. And we only ever did one, but it was great. Loads of people turned up. We had some good speakers. I did my first kind of major public speaking event, and Pete Carroll was there, and Ralph Tegmeyer was there, a couple of other people speaking, and yeah, it was a terrific success. And the after party at Ray Sherwin's was an amazing networking experience, just like people from from all over the British occult scene, plus people from the German speaking world, Germany, Switzerland, Austria. So it was just, it really, I think that was the year it really blew open, 1987.
I suppose then at some stage, going into the 90s, maybe the bubble burst, there seems to be a kind of a point where arguments start to happen. And obviously, not asking you to air out any dirty laundry or anything like that, but was there a peak time, you would say, before it kind of...
That was basically 1990 to 91. There was a big split in the IOT, which Pete Carroll referred to as the Ice War. And he's published various online things about this.
People, this is with Frater UD, is that, am I correct?
Was Ralph Tegmeyer's Frater UV. Yeah. So that was, you can read his side of the argument online. I think Tegmeyer has published a lot less about it, or maybe almost nothing. So it tends to be, the narrative tends to have been, you know, all derived from Pete Carroll. But yeah, so that that was a big split in the IOT. Pete Carroll left as leader in 1991, and kind of in a way, he sort of walked out rather abruptly, leaving it in other people's hands. But that ended up being a really good thing. Okay. Because, you know, you've probably heard of founder syndrome in various organizations, you know, where the person who founds an organization is no longer, you know, it, because other people are involved, the values of the organization grow beyond that person's values. And so what happened as Pete walked away, there was this tremendous kind of like surge in different directions. And his attempts to sort of come back since in various ways weren't entirely, you know, weren't very successful, because it had already, his child had grown away from him. And so there was a continued expansion in the 90s, but of a different sort. And I think that's when Chaos Magic really started to come of age.
Yeah, I think most people that I would know now who've got into Chaos Magic got into it more in the 90s, and probably Grant Morrison being, you know, the reason for an awful lot of it, was when you started seeing things like Grant Morrison talking about hyper sigils, and, you know, Alan Moore had obviously been talking about magic, not too much at that stage, but, you know, later on. Were you a comic fan? Were you aware of that stuff going on, or what do you think about
only
that?
Only later, really. I mean, I've always liked Alan Moore's stuff, and I read from the 80s onwards. I quite often read 2000 AD comic, and so I was aware of, you know, Grant Morrison was doing things even back then in 2000 AD, wasn't he? I don't know whether...
Yeah, you've seen Zenith, was that his big one?
Alan Moore was doing... that one about the young lass who stows away on a starship?
Halo Jones.
Yes, yeah. So there was... So I was enjoying those serials at that stage, but I didn't realise... And, of course, there was obvious magical content in some of that stuff, particularly... Yeah. More explicitly in Grant Morrison's stuff. But it was a few more years, really. It was more like the late 90s that I started to realise how, you know, that these people were actually practising magicians, and which is, you know, a delight to learn that there's people out there who are putting this stuff out into the world. Isn't it funny how some of the most advanced writing has come up through the comics world?
Sure, yeah, it seems...
Incredible how that's happened, isn't it? Pat Mills is another one. I follow him on. He's still around. Yeah. And all of that stuff, you know, Slane, and all of those stories, very magical. And
seems to be some sort of connection between, I suppose, magic and art and comics and writing, that it's like, I'm sure that there's plenty of magic books, if you want, you know, like stories about magic or books about magic, but it doesn't seem to have the level that comics has incorporated magic, you know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's just it really is. It's just really raw and vivid, and a sense that these people know what, even though this is fantasy writing, that these people nonetheless know something about the underlying ideas of magic, you know, and that comes over in their work. And that guy who did Luther Arkwright, what's he called?
I have it here. I do know. There wasn't his name. What is
it? I love his stuff as well. I mean, I was into his stuff way back in 1980. And that was, I mean, that was more sci-fi.
Brian Talbot. Thank God. Yeah. Well done, Brian.
All of those people were into an area of sort of sci-fi fantasy that was beginning to move into magic at the very least, and if not actually explicitly magical.
And so, did any of them turn up at any point in any of the meetings or any of the gatherings, or was there any communication? Like, did Alan Moore turn up at any point? Or
No. I met Alan Moore briefly in 1997 at an event that Mog Morgan put on in London called Ananke. And I did a talk there about bringing together the currents of magic and psychedelics. It's always been an interest of mine, of course. And I wrote a little, I did a little talk about that. And Alan Moore was there and doing one of his, looking at the layers of time in one area. And because we were in Conway Hall in London, he did Holborn, you know, that area of London. And I love those performances of his. And that was really great. And I got to sort of meet him and briefly shake his hand afterwards. But he didn't seem very communicative, because, I mean, you know, it's like you've just done a big performance and you're not naturally that outgoing a person, perhaps. No. I see that you probably wouldn't want to shake everybody's hands and have a lengthy conversation with him. So it's okay, you know, we just went our way. So that's the only time I ever met him. But About the same year, I was when I brought out my Chaotopia, the first edition of it, and that was the first lengthy book I'd written. I mean, I'd written a book on incense making in 1991, and then I'd written some other stuff. I'd written a book on wealth magic, which is still out there, in 93, I think. And but I hadn't written a full-length book about magic in general, and that was my first one. And I did self-publish that. And when it was all ready to go, and I made some flyers up on a computer, you know, made some little flyers up on what used to be called DTP in those days, and to leave around and get go. And I thought, oh, Grant Morrison, he's obviously into magic. So I'll send one to him via his publisher in New York. So I sent it to Vertigo Press in New York, this little flyer about my book and a little cover note saying, "Dear Mr. Morrison, you know, I imagine you're into chaos magic. Perhaps you'd be interested in my new book," kind of thing.
Yeah.
About just over a week later, I was taking a break from work. At that time, I was living in Nottingham because I was trying to open another branch of the aromatics business, which didn't do terribly well, so we pulled it back. But I was living in Nottingham and working really long hours on that. And one day I sort of nipped home for a bit of lunch and just to sit for half an hour, and the phone rang, you know, an actual landline phone. So this is the days of mobile. So this is like really improbable. And I pick it up and it's Grant Morrison calling.
Wow.
Book, you know, we had quite a lengthy chat about magic. And then about 2 years later, I was going out with this lass who was a violinist, and she did a performance as part of a thing where Grant Morrison was giving a talk and things. So I got to meet him in the flesh there. Right. So yeah, really nice bloke. Yeah, really very pleasant chap.
That's quite cool that you rang him up. And it's so weird, like when you think of like even talking about the, you know, the old phones, and like if a phone rang now, you'd gone, something's obviously wrong, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. So who else was coming on the scene around that time? I suppose Randy Dukes would have been about at that point too. Was there, did you interact with him? Was he on the scene in the same way? Or
yeah, a bit. I read his book SSOTBME in about 1979 and thought, oh, he's definitely in on this current. Mm. Of course, I didn't really understand the full, you know, historical nature of it then. Of course, it was really him. Robert Anton Wilson is, in a way, the spiritual ancestor of chaos magic, because he came up with the idea of multi-model agnosticism.
Sure.
That unless you have a whole bunch of belief systems about how the world works, you're throttling your life down to unnecessarily. Mm. And yet there's something scary about having all those different belief systems and moving between them. So he kind of established that. And then Lionel, at about the same time, I mean, we're talking 1974, I think that book came out.
Oh, is it that early? Is it really?
Yeah. Right, SSO, right. I think, was 74.
Right. I, in my head, assumed it came out after Liebernold for some reason. I'm not.
No, definitely before. So he was another of the ancestors of chaos magic, as I saw it initially. But yes, he was a very friendly person. I can't remember how I first started communicating with him, but
but he wasn't part of that initial group or anything. No, he kind of got to the same place on his, I suppose, by doing his own.
Yeah,
role,
that's right, really. And I knew him more through the Oxford Thelemic Symposium and stuff like that. Meet him there and have a chat with him in the mid '80s, and but then in 1990. I think this must have been 1991 or two. No, it's 90. Yeah, somewhere around there, maybe 92. One of the IoT World meetings, and they always had, in those days, they always had a public-facing part. So there'd be, like, for instance, a two-day meeting, which was open to the public, and there would be, like, loads of talks and workshops and rituals. And then the public would leave, and there'd be the maybe two or three days of closed meeting
for the people
where we have our own mad scene. And Lionel Snell was invited to speak at, it was 1991, that's right, because it was the first world meeting I ever went to. He was invited to speak at that, and somebody, I think it was Ian Reed and somebody else, had to go to the airport to pick him up to take this gig in Austria. So they're driving from some airport in Austria, and they were given strict instructions to initiate him in the car, so he couldn't.
awesome.
So cool. He was kind of like, you know, given he was made a full member in the car. He'd been around the scene, and he just saw it as a wonderful sort of Discordian joke and everything. And but he was actually, you know, he came to other meetings and was really a really good member. But he always did his own thing, you know. But yes,
I think the first time I heard of Dave Lee was the Baptist Head podcast, and I think that's about 2006, would that be right, or 2005, that you did?
Sounds about right, yes.
So without jumping, I suppose, too quick straight to that, because that's nearly a decade after what we've been talking about, what was going on? There was a few books between then, probably, was there, or there was more before you got to the, I suppose, the Alan Chapman era?
A few more books, a few more influential writers. Yeah, I mean, the layer after Pete Carroll and Ray Sherwin and Ramsey Jukes, Lionel Snow were the first, and then you get the next layer, I suppose you could say, would have been Phil Hine,
right.
Who was always, I don't know, I mean, I always struggled with articulating things, and so I was much slower in bringing anything out, even though I was on that scene sooner. I mean, I kind of headhunted Phil Hine in a way for the IOT, and but he then, you know, he started developing communication about the magic much earlier than I did. So his early books were coming out in the early 90s and so forth, or mid 90s maybe. So there was that layer of it. And then Julian Vane coming along, and there was his work. Mm-hmm. Ian Reid was always a massive influence, but he never wrote books. He doesn't really like...
That's the thing, because I'm not really familiar with the name even.
No, that's it, you see. It's when the history of this era comes to be written for future generations, then I hope that people will recognise that some of the prominent, some of the people who are fairly prominent because they had a strong social profile were nothing like as influential as some of the people who appear to be behind the scenes. Like,
Ian
Ingrid took over the British section of the IOT when Pete Carroll left and really built it up. You know, we're still mourning Ingrid. She died just a few months ago.
Oh, right, okay.
But she was an amazing influence on the whole thing, and so was Ian. And I think he's really the person who is worth mentioning in that regard. There was someone else. There was one other person who wrote very little, although he's rather an interesting character from the early days, Charlie Brewster.
No, I'm not familiar with that name either.
Okay, well, he only ever wrote one book, as far as I'm aware, called Liber Cyber. And it's, I think I can find it here and show you how sort of its era it was just by looking at it. Here it is. It's on my top shelf where all the really obscure chaos magic books are. So it's like...
Oh, right, yeah.
A4, you know, stuff with, you know, TypeScript pages.
Spiral bound.
yeah, that's it. So this is his own sort of tales of magic, and I never met him. He disappeared off the scene. Anyway, the stories are that he did some amazing things with the stock market, but it all came to an end, and he sort of disappeared. But there was the next generation. Yeah, would have been Phil Hine, and then kind of like Julian Vane,
and I suppose then at that point the internet was starting to become a thing, so there was probably Chaos Magic Online and those type of things.
That's right, yeah.
Were you an early adopter of the internet, or did it affect your magic or your writing in any way? Or
well, by 1993 I was section head of the British section of the IOT, and so I needed to talk to people abroad a lot. And I couldn't afford phone calls, so I was delighted when email came along, because I really was too slow for some of these things. So it was just great. So I adopted email in 93. I had an email.
Oh, really? That early? That's pretty cool.
I had a CompuServe email address, which was something like 10707785 at CompuServe. Three addresses. And then, you know, then it got better every few months after that. But yeah, I had email in 93, but I didn't really bother. And the first time I ever really searched the internet, I was really impressed by how much you could find out.
Yeah. And all the books, all the badly typed out books that were available at the time.
Yeah. So that that was a time of great change. But yeah, all of that's happening really before the Alan Chapman era, which is really the early noughties, I think. I met Alan through the IoT.
Right, okay.
This
was him previous to Baptist Head and all that kind of stuff. It was him just arriving on the scene type of thing, was it?
Yeah, really. I'd never heard of this guy. He is just somebody, you know, a new guy along on the scene and seemed interesting. And then quite a few years later, he put, you know, he came, you know, I knew him from various meetings and got on okay with him. And then all of a sudden he produced that book. I don't know what year that was, Advanced Magic for Beginners.
Oh, I have to assume it's 2008, is it 2009, something like that?
And I think, so I'd have been aware, I'm probably aware of Baptist Head before that. And used to follow it and read about it. And I think the first time that I saw that I really kind of like glommed onto what Alan was doing was when we had a Chaos Magic meeting in London, in, I think it was in 08. And he did a talk called Magic, Magic with a K, how to spell magic with a K.
Very cool. Well,
the way that Chaos had sort of, had kind of like swept aside all of that Crowley stuff about higher consciousness and spiritual awakening and how he was bringing it back. So that was very inspiring. And from that point on, I began to reevaluate my relationship with the idea of awakening.
Yeah, look, because I think, I suppose what I really enjoyed about Alan and Duncan was that whole thing that the, you know, brought back in a kind of, because it was the question I was asking you earlier, was there an overall, you know, theme or arc to your work? And I find in a lot of kind of, I suppose, in chaos magic, that can be missing, you know, that it's just kind of doing sigils to get the stuff, you know, to pay your rent or to, you know, whatever, get your ex-boyfriend back, whatever is the story. Whereas with the Alan and Duncan stuff, there was just kind of, oh no, you know, there's a reason for all this. We're doing, you know, there's a kind of a, in that kind of weird low magic, high magic divide, you know, that kind of thing. So I find that very interesting. So do you recognize that as well? Is it something that you wanted to pursue, I suppose, the kind of enlightenment part of magic?
Yes, indeed. Yes, I did. And there was, before that, actually, there was another phase in, I mean, I know what you mean about, you know, after a while, chaos magic, if approached in the sort of, you know, the fundamentalist Carolian sort of fashion, is a bit limiting after a while. It's just, you know, you can do sigils for this, that, and the other. But it's, after a while, in fact, you mostly end up doing, if you're doing practical magic, I think you mostly end up doing it for other people, don't you? Because your own life, your own life does actually start to click into place and things do get better as your magic improves. So in the end, you only really do spells. So when, you know, for maybe things you believe in changing in the world or for someone who needs a bit of help.
Yeah, if someone gets sick or something like that.
Yeah, that sort of thing. So that's tended to be most of my magic for a long, long time. But at some point, you know, in the 90s, I recognized this process and thought, I want to study some tradition really deeply. And I'd, you know, I'd been interested in various traditions. I've been interested in the I Ching, for instance, and Taoism. I've been interested a bit in Tantra and in Voodoo. But I thought, I need to study a tradition that's close to home, because it's such a rabbit hole. Once you go into a tradition, it is such a rabbit hole. There's so many different things. So I decided to study the Northern tradition, the, you know, Germanicism. And I joined the Rune Guild in January 96, and started my work on the Nine Doors of Midgard, you know, the initiatic program of the Rune Guild. So I was already stepping out of the kind of fundamentalist chaos frame, if you like.
Yeah.
By the time I collided with Alan's mystical discourse. But yes, I recognized in what Alan was doing something that I really longed for. I thought, okay, this is finally beginning to join up all the different strands that I'd had since my teenage acid trips and the, you know, getting into sorcery, sort of chaos sorcery sort of stuff, and then getting into the traditional stuff. And where does it all join together? Where does it all link up? Where's the invisible point at the center of that mandala?
Yeah.
And it was Alan, you know, it was Alan showing that not only is awakening a real thing, but it can be achieved and it's worth achieving, all of those things. Because I went to, for instance, of how I was still put off by most people's discourse about awakening, I went on a Vipassana retreat in 2005.
Okay.
So in Hereford, you probably heard of the centre there. You go along, you pay a voluntary contribution, you have 10 or 11 days of complete silence and no socializing and no boozing or smoking or anything like that.
No fun whatsoever.
Fun is allowed, yeah. And you just sit for, you know, kind of 6 hours a day, basically doing meditation. And there's about an hour or more a day of Mr. Goenka, the founder of that institution.
These the videos that get
on DVD from Mr. Goenka. And you know they do sort of sell Vipassana as a completely what's the word I'm looking for? Non-denominational approach to meditation. You know, do this. And I think that's an amazing organization. I mean, in India, they've got like tens of thousands of people meditating in prison.
All right, cool. Yeah.
Imagine if you're just some person who's been nicked for something, you've probably had a horrible life, you're bunged in prison, and somebody teaches you to meditate. That'd be an amazing thing. That's such a cool. Yeah. So I really like a lot of what they're doing, and I respected them from the start, but they're not really non-denominational. I mean, in Goenka's talks, you realize that he's talking a model which is entirely about reincarnation. And it's a really like, if you meditate for 2 hours a day for the next, I don't know what he said, but let's say 10,000 lifetimes, it's something like that, you know,
right, okay.
You might achieve, you know, a full awakening. Right. And so I just came home and thought, no.
No.
I read more of their literature and the you know, and practiced for a while, but I fell away from it quite quickly. I thought, what's the point? You know, there's some exotic state of consciousness that you might be able to achieve in some future incarnation. What's that about? Who cares?
Yeah. Thousands of years, maybe.
Yeah, so I was still pretty cynical about the whole thing, even at that stage. And then, you know, but Alan, you know, Alan and Duncan interviewed me for the Baptist Head, and I got into a really long dialogue with them from then onwards. I think that was about 07. And and I thought, no, this stuff is for me. This definitely is for me. Here's someone, as I watched Alan progressing, I realized here's someone, I'm seeing someone in the process of awakening, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've got his own way of doing it. He cobbled together various systems, and eventually him and Duncan had both got a result out of it. And it was a result such as can only be described as a spiritual awakening. And here's, you know, they're talking about how they did it, and here you can do it too. It's not something that's in the remote distant future. It's not something that's almost impossible, and it's not something that's almost pointless. You know, it's the opposite of all those things.
Yeah, so it's very kind of practical, very pragmatic, you know, this is it. And very honest too, you know, the ups and downs and all of those things. It's quite refreshing, because the whole kind of awakening enlightenment thing is usually presented as 10,000 lifetimes, you know.
Yeah,
it's for the select few, you know, that kind of stuff. And my thing, which I got from Alan and Duncan, was that, well, if it is possible and people are doing it, you know, then it could be possible for me too, you know, that it's that kind of if one person can do it, then surely anyone can do it.
Yeah. You know,
which was what got me into chaos magic in the first place, in that it's not just for the elite, it's not just for the, you know, the secret societies, it's, you know, we can all do this, you know.
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, obviously what Alan's doing has come a long way from Pete Carroll's chaos magic, but I still think that chaos magic was an important influence on what Alan's doing.
I would say so too,
like you're saying, it's that sort of honest and skeptical approach to the whole process. This kind of open-ended approach is very chaos-like. And I mean, I'd done my own hypersigil. When I wrote that book, Chaotopia, this was to some extent a hypersigil to bring the same discourse, the same critical discourse that had so well informed practical magic in the chaos magic era into mysticism, so that we could have the sort of chaos mysticism equivalent. And I regard it as a success, because people started writing about, you know, Julian Vane wrote a bit about his relationship with his HGA in the next book he brought out. And then, you know, a few years later, Alan started writing and publishing. So
you're to blame for all of this, then, is what you're
saying? Yeah, it's all my fault.
So where are, you know, what is, you know, where are, well, I know, but what's your current kind of practice? What are you doing? Where is your head at these days?
Well, I mean, my practice at the moment consists of, you know, half an hour's meditation a day along the lines that Alan prescribes. He talks about three different meditations, you know, Beloved, Fire, and Underworld. And so I tend to, you know, alternate between those on a spontaneous kind of basis. But I try to make sure I get a meditation in every day. I very seldom miss it. When I first started daily meditation, I think that was 2011. And I sort of took a vow, you know, April of that year, that I was going to like really go for it and do it every day instead of just, you know, mucking about with it. And it took me 6 months to get a real taste for it. You know, it's kind of like, oh, I've got to do it.
So yeah, first, yeah, the chore.
I really started to miss it if I didn't have a session.
All right, great.
I've always found that if I've got some daily magical work to do, that it really improves my mood. I am subject, like a lot of people, to low mood from time to time. And having daily magical work to do just massively improves that situation. Just the fact that I've got somewhere I can go each day where I just, whatever mood I'm in, I'm falling into the center of everything.
Yeah.
You know, that where all the action is, in a sense, or all the inaction is. And
so it's having a sense of sacredness in your life, you know, that is important, which is missing an awful lot from contemporary life, I suppose.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's no point at the center of the mandala of modern or postmodern culture. It's just a sort of marsh of a sort of mess, isn't it? You've only got your own resources. You have to keep coming back and, you know, going to that point, that vanishing point at the center of it all, so that you can recognize that not only are you in time, but you're in eternity. And, you know, not only is there all the confusion of communication, but there's also silence and all of those things.
Yeah, it's much needed. So you have a new teaching course out, or two, as far as I know. It's a two separate courses. Can you tell us all a bit about that?
Yeah, well, it's only 6 days ago now. I opened my Chaotopia School of Magic on the Teachable platform.
Right.
And you might not have heard of Teachable. It doesn't matter in itself. It's a platform where you can create a school. And I've got about 10 courses planned. I've already launched two of them. I've got a third ready to go. The first two I've launched are Exploring Breathwork, which... I brought out a book called Life Force. Mm-hmm.
Great book, really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Sensed energy in breathwork, chaos magic, and psychedelia. And it's the first part one, that's in five parts. Part one of that is about the techniques of different styles of breathwork. And so this course, kind of like, in a way, it's like a practice-based course based on that first part one of Life Force. Okay. So that's the ideal companion for it. And it's a big course, you know, 17 videos and various downloadable PDFs and various exercises to do, sort of thing that you could easily take 6 months over.
Right.
And a lot about eight different styles of breath work. And the other course I put up there, I wanted to put one paying course up there. That's one's got a price on it. But I wanted to put a free course up as well. It brings attention to the school.
So I can
get free stuff. But also because it involves stuff. The course is entirely made up of stuff that I didn't invent. So I can't charge money for anyway. But it's just presentations of various methods called magical self-care. And it's kind of an overview of different... I've described it as the tips of many icebergs of magical technique that help towards maintaining health and about healing. So there's a bit about pranayama in there. There's a bit about using connected breath work interrupt negative states. There's a bit about visualization and aura work, and then it ends on the use of a magical healing spirit, which was created originally by the IOT, but has been released to the world about 20 years ago. That's a very powerful kind of spirit entity. So that's the free course, and I think about 40 people have already signed up for that.
Great. And would you advise people to start with the free course? Is that a good primer for the other course, or can you jump straight into the main course if you want to
either? It's what you want, really. But I mean, you know, having a free course which is about magical self-care, I think, is very apt at the moment, because, you know, people's the public health situation, and what's more, people's fears about the public health situation and the negative states people get themselves into because of lockdown and all that sort of stuff. I think it's probably the reason, you know, some of the reasons why that's been so so successful. But no, it doesn't really relate to the other course. There's a right. tiny overlap in the breath work. The third one I'm going to be releasing, I've got to make some extra videos for it. It's one that I've done live, and both in person and online. It's called Introduction to Rune Magic.
Oh, right, okay.
That's going to be a slightly shorter course, probably about 10 videos. And that is kind of basic runic sorcery. You know, it's how to use the runes to do basic magic. But it also incorporates rune song, because one of my favorite methods of getting into a magical high is singing.
Okay.
And, you know, that there's something about that on there. And there's also going to be a masterclass on rune singing as well, a separate thing.
Great stuff. When people join up Teachable, it's is it just that you get a load of videos, or is there interaction with you? Can you send you questions? What way does that all work?
All of these courses are no interaction. They're just lifetime access of videos and PDFs, and some audio files. So they're lifetime access. You can take as long as you want, but you don't get any personal interaction with me unless you actually come into the... I offer personal coaching with each of these as well. So people can book an hour on Zoom with me for individual coaching on particular things. And I think that's probably the way to do it. So they're just something you create and leave there for people, really.
Right. And is it it's kind of download it, can use it the phone, all of that kind of stuff, I assume. You can get it in, the phone, to get it in their, desktop. It's accessed through any kind of
You can access it through the phone or the computer.
Great stuff. So anything else or anything we missed out on, or anything else you want to talk about or mention before we go?
I think that's most of it. I mean, that's my main kind of, like, that's my big new outward facing thing. I suppose the main other public facing thing I do, which I suppose you could put in your notes or something, is that site, it's my newsletter.
People
sign up to that, you get the news of all the courses that are coming out that I'm doing, and also some of my kind of like current obsessions and links to all sorts of weird stuff in the world.
Very interesting. I always look forward to getting them.
So
I'll put all of the stuff in the show notes, which is the Teachable stuff, the mailing list stuff. Is there the website? The website still going at this point?
That's kind of like a bit of a building site at the moment. Because I'm changing the front page into something which will link more directly to School of Chaotopia, but I'm having a bit of difficulty with some of the link technology there, and I've got to help ticket with Teachable on about that at the moment, so that'll take a few days. But the website's still usable, it just looks a bit scruffy when you first go in,
which is fine, but we can get over that. Well, thank you very much, Dave. I really, really enjoyed that chat. It was very, very insightful and informative, and I always enjoy talking to you, and hopefully at some stage in the future we'll get to do this again. So thank you very much.
Great stuff. Cheers, Tommy, it's been fun.